Hello, this is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And it's still the frozen Arctic out there. Even Roger's not out in the garden displaying his knees to the birds.
Well, I was having a pipe earlier before we started recording.
All right. You are the explorer of the great outdoors. I am the poor old man cowering in his nice warm flat.
Well, I do get the weather report from Cat. Apparently it's cold and wet out there.
Well, this month we're going to be talking about demonstrating things. Not on the streets, but in the gaming session.
How do you show off a system? How do you run a one-off convention game?
And other related topics will be spilling from our wise old heads. And Roger also wants to have a rant. We'll let him have a rant at the end of the programme.
Only a little bit of mathematics, honest.
Gah!
Onward. Oh, before we onward, thank you to Joseph Hagen and John Reynolds, who both put some money in our tip jar.
We thank you, gentlemen, and we promise to keep on doing the things we keep on doing.
Onward.
There came up on To Kill a Lee, a excellent site for talking about role-playing games, you may have heard us mention, a question about what was the best way, what would be the best way, to run a demo game, a demonstration game for a particular role-playing game. I think the chap who was doing it was talking about doing it for his local, friendly local games shop. And it occurred to me that we have here in studio an expert on this, or at least somebody's done it once or twice for money, which is Roger. And I thought we could pontificate at each other. So, Roger.
Well, let's just say, using the term money loosely, I got paid A, peanuts, and B, in products when I was doing this.
They're making peanut products out of peanuts nowadays. What will they think of next?
But, yeah, for several years I would generally write one or two adventures a year and run them as GURPS demonstrations at various conventions. And so suddenly I got a feel from that as to what tends to work. And so for clarity, this is generally with a group of people who might know me, but it's open sign up. And what they know signing up is it's this system, it's this GM, and here is a rough synopsis of what the adventure is about. Sometimes at the larger conventions they have to pay for a ticket, usually a pound or two. Generally not.
Well, the closest I came to that was in a burst of community patriotism at the last London Worldcon. I ran a introductory GURPS fantasy adventure, and I got somebody turn up who had no experience of GURPS and no knowledge of it, and it turned into impromptu teaching people GURPS and introducing them to the features of it, which is my small thread of knowing what I'm talking about in this.
Generally, what I've done has been a four-hour slot, which seems to be the standard. And the key thing, I think, which might be different for a game shop demo, is that there is no plausible "and next time we will do this," because there may not be a next time, and if there is, it'll probably be a new one-shot adventure.
Yeah.
Now, also, many years ago, do you remember The Last Province, role-playing magazine?
Oh, lovely thing. I think I've got a complete set of it, yes.
Yeah,
it's
me too.
Lovely.
I had a piece in that, which was basically what makes a convention game different from a campaign game.
Right.
So I've been doing this for a while. Whether I'm any good at it, the players can say, but I have had repeat players, so, you know.
Okay, well, that is always the highest form of flattery for a GM.
This has included things like Games Expo, which, well, yeah, why I'd stopped doing it at Game Expo is a whole separate thing and nothing to do with how I run the demos, more in terms of the facilities available to me, so let's not talk about that. It's not relevant to this. What I would say is, for a games shop demo, you have the potential to make that a gaming group depending on how the shop wants to do it. I mean, they yeah. might say open demo, come and learn about, or they might say here's an actual gaming group, and then they will have a recurring source of buyers of dice and rule books and whatever. So yeah, whatever. Step one, I guess, would be picking a system. For me, this was easy because if I demoed GURPS, they would give me money. Okay. See previous comment, not actual money.
Not actual money, virtual money, money-ish.
But you know, a game you're enthusiastic about, obviously. When I was doing this at the Yogg-Sothoth.com Games Days, a moment of silence for Yogg-Sothoth.com. The brief was basically a Lovecraftian game, so I could quite happily run that in GURPS, but it would still be essentially a Lovecraftian adventure. Hmm. If the shop has a particular thing they want to sell, then they might well feel, well, we would like you to demo this because we have it in stock and the players can step away from the game and say, yeah, that was good, I want to buy that.
Yeah, that seems the primary motivation for most shops, shockingly.
And I think that immediate accessibility is a good thing rather than, oh, well, yes, we don't keep this obscure system in stock, but we can order it for you. With that said, I have negative experience of advertising a game as GURPS, because I think if people have heard of GURPS but not played it,
yeah,
they have generally heard bad stuff. Like, it's that game where you have to do unreasonably complicated thing just to have a sailing boat. And the answer is, well, no, you just use the stats for the sailing boat that's in a book somewhere. Or if you really want to design one from scratch, yeah, you can go and look at GURPS vehicles, but you don't do that at the table. But you know, they don't know the full ramifications of this. They've just heard, ooh, it's got this really complicated thing in it, I don't want to play that.
Yeah, well, I think the major barrier in GURPS is the character building, which yes. is something everybody runs into. But that's not a problem at a convention or a demo game. That's done for you.
Well, I would say, although there are games in which you can quickly run up a character, GURPS is absolutely not one of them, and every GURPS demo I've run, there has always been a pre-gen character. In fact, I did an experiment with this at a few StabCons ago, pre-pandemic. I basically offered the same game, the same blurb and so on, and the only difference in the listings was this one is in GURPS and that one is in the Cthulhu hack, which is a very lightweight system, which I suspect most people wouldn't have heard of.
Yeah.
Certainly when I ran it, I had to explain it rather than them saying, oh, I'm a serious hack fan, I want to play this. And I simply got twice as many sign-ups or more for the Cthulhu hack game than I did for the GURPS game.
Well, this is sad for our particular affinities.
I would say just be careful about it. I mean, if you are doing GURPS, say, well, yeah, you know, beginners welcome or something like that, which is going to be the case anyway. I think that's generally assumed for a convention game of this sort. But I think it's worth emphasising.
Yeah, I was going to say that my primary bit of advice for demoing any role-playing game would be to display what the game is about, what its core activity is, in Robin Laws's terms. But that's a problem with a generic system, somewhat. I mean, when I did that Worldcon game, I was concentrating on doing a Banestorm game, doing a game with all the bells and whistles, if at a low level, of a GURPS fantasy adventure. I wanted to show off those bits of the system, the low level combat, the low level magicians. That was the thing I was highlighting. But yeah. I'm not sure GURPS has got one unique feature.
Well, I think there is some personal bias in this for me, because I tend to like games in what I have stolen the historian's term and called the long 20th century, which you might say sort of 1850, 1860-ish, up to more or less present day.
Hmm.
That is an era that I like to run games in. I also think that it is an era that GURPS not only does well, but does better than most of the plausible competition.
Hmm.
Immediate recognisability and engagement is important here.
Yeah.
And sadly, going down the dungeon and hitting things is a thing that people will recognise and understand.
I'm not sure that an absolute role-playing virgin will understand. But even they have been exposed to Stranger Things and other things.
Yeah.
And cultural references going back to E.T.
And for that, honestly, I wouldn't pick GURPS, because I think if you already have an idea of what that is about, then what you probably have is an idea of what that is about in the D&D lens. So you could do D&D, you could do Pathfinder, but anything that gets much further than that, it's not going to work the way people expect it to work. Another thing I think works well is action films.
Mm, yeah.
That's generally the sort of thing I would pick for GURPS. Popular franchises like Star Wars, Star Trek, they both have official games associated with them these days, yeah, which are not terrible. I don't know what the state of the Star Wars is with it, but that's just because I'm not terribly interested. Modern horror goes well as well. Not necessarily Call of Cthulhu, though it could be. But there I would say consider boundaries and consider, you're dealing with a bunch of strangers who may have their own quirks and tics and things they don't want to talk about. So while I would have an X card anyway, I think it is particularly important with a horror game, because there may just be moments when people suddenly say, no, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
The other problem with a horror game, of course, is relatively few chances to be heroic, depending on the sort of horror.
I think there should always be a chance to be heroic at the very end.
Well, yes, I mean, remembering the Dread, was it, game that you ran at a StabCon, where the heroic thing I did was realise that a PC sacrifice was needed and volunteer to be it. So,
yeah. I will say, I did have one opportunity. My one point of being a paid GM came up when somebody came into the Wednesday nightclub and said he wanted somebody to run a Call of Cthulhu adventure for his birthday and to show his family what he'd been going on about all this time. And that was a fascinating. I'm not sure I did it terribly well, but I gave them a good solid evening's worth of, here's what happens now. What do you want to do now? What do you want to do now? Which sort of worked, I think. But as I say, it wasn't an ideal thing, and I would do it very differently now.
Well, that's a trick with engagement, particularly in a limited time slot. Any time you say, what do you want to do next, the players should be able to come up with something fairly quickly. And a world that they understand is a great help to that.
They were being investigators in America in the 1920s. I may have blown at that particular requirement.
But I would also say the competition for attracting new role players is video games.
This is true.
So my inclination is to do stuff that video games can't or don't do.
You're going to say that you should do things like social interaction, personal whatchamacallitness, and improvising. And I'm going to say I would go for doing the things that video games are impersonating, which is on the map scaled tactical combat.
Yeah, I'm just remembering when I first met, was it Hero Quest, Dungeon Quest, those GW games of the 80s and 90s, where it was basically a board game of you were going down a dungeon.
Yeah,
my feeling at that point was, this board game does the dungeon bashing experience without anything weird and extra way better than a great big heavyweight role playing system. Why not just leave that to that and keep the role-playing system for the role-playing? And that's still the way I feel now, that the video game can do the dungeon-bashing experience with fully rendered dungeon walls and slime and everything. Why bother?
Because it's a fun experience for me. Honestly, I as a GM, it's not something I normally do. Normally my games are Theatre of the Mind. But I am well aware of the limits of theatre of the mind and the trouble I get into when I think my descriptions are perfectly clear and the players think my descriptions aren't. So,
well, there's a thing I've used there, which came out of the Cambridge group, which is I will work entirely in descriptions, but if the players ask for a map, I will sketch a map.
But the thing is, I don't normally want to do the effort of creating a map, a set of figures specific for the game, cardboard heroes specific for the game. And I am lazy. It's my leading characteristics.
I have never done that. I don't do tactical map games.
Yeah, but I think it is one of the things that is impressive, and I actually think that GURPS does it well, which is why
Days never seen a hex grid. They're weirdos.
They into our own miniatures back then. There was none of this send it off and order somebody else to paint it.
Well, yeah, that's another thing. You may have had different early gaming experiences, but when I was getting started in the 80s, there were people who had miniatures and maps, but they were the rich kids who could afford miniatures and full-size maps and probably had their dad's photocopier involved in the latter.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of people I knew did not do that, and nobody thought that was weird or hard to play with or anything.
Okay, so hang on. Pulling back, having faced that difference of opinion between us.
Well, there's a slightly different angle I want to look at in terms of things that video games don't do, which is actual physical dice, actual physical character sheets. There is a tactile joy to that, which should not be ignored.
I will agree there's a tactile physical joy in rolling dice and in the moment while the dice are falling and before they come down and triumph or joy. Yeah, it's very emotional making. And when I press the button and tell the computer to do it, it isn't there at all. I'm just going to be frustrated or whatever.
And many computers lie. Many games lie, I should say. They'll tell you have a 98% chance of doing something, but it's actually 95%.
Ah. Well, why do they do that?
Make it more exciting.
All right. Perversely, I think it's more exciting when the chance is lower, because never mind. But I'm not sure I've ever oohed and aahed over a character sheet. That's just an adjunct to.
No, but it's way easier to use one on paper than one on a tablet.
Ah, point taken. Yes,
or a
screen. Though you can't actually just click on it and get a result from the system. I would say that creating the character sheets is an art in itself for any demo or convention game. I broke one of Roger's laws when I handed him a character sheet which had a two-sided A4 explanation of what it was all about at StabCon, and he didn't throw me out the window.
I had one. You told me you were breaking one of my rules, and I hadn't worked out until now which one it was, so fair enough.
Oh dear, never mind.
But, yeah, I would say, well, most games that one is going to demonstrate are modern games and have relatively straightforward sheets. If I were doing it for GURPS, as a thing I worked out for GCA4 using the character sheet formatter, which is basically strip off all the points, because points are there for improvement.
Yes, and from a point of view of a demo game, They're utterly irrelevant.
You do not need to know what this ability cost.
Yeah.
The other thing I did for GURPS was in the notes to go along with the character sheet, I would generally put a summary of the key advantages and disadvantages. Because a skill, it's pretty obvious what it's for, lockpicking, gun, whatever. bad temper, it's fairly obvious what it's for, but it's nice to know here is the actual rule that goes with it.
Yeah.
And that is what I would generally do. This comes from my general idea when I'm playing somebody else's GURPS game with a pre-gen, the first thing I look at on the character is the disadvantages, because that tells me what their personality is like, as opposed to the nifty stuff they can do.
I think I would... Whatever the system is, I tend to put in a note about here's how this character could be role-played. Not should be, but could be role-played. Pointers to he's bad-tempered, he's proud, his motivation is this and that. But that's going to be... I'm going to be composing a prose description, short or long, of what the character is, and handing that out with the actual game stats. Because once I've composed the character, I want to do a description, hopefully in less than the side of A4, of who they are, why they're here, and everything that the player needs to absorb before he picks up his dice.
Yeah, I'm vaguely inclined, to do that as two separate things. One is the official character sheet, which is the one with all the numbers on it.
Yeah,
and the other is, here is who this person is, because, as we've said before, and possibly you're downplaying this a bit in a demo game, but that's the thing that interests me, that who this person is who isn't me, and how they will react to these situations.
You want to be careful. I normally say first person at the table gets first pick. But I have in the past, and I did at StabCon, choose people to do particular things which I thought they were capable of doing well.
Well, it helps if you know the people, as you know.
Yeah.
Many of the StabCon role players are old hands at it, and we've played with them before.
Hmm. So, but assuming that they are newbies to you and newbies to the system, what special actions do you need to take?
Well, when I've been doing GURPS, I have what I call the 5-minute GURPS teach, which actually takes less than that. Which is basically, okay, that section of the sheet is your skills. When I ask for a skill roll, you roll 3d6 and tell me how much you get below the skill. And that's more or less it. And then similarly, you know, these four big numbers over here are your stats: strength, dexterity, intelligence, health. There are your advantages and disadvantages. Those are things that aren't skills that affect how good or bad your character is at particular things.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a game with special powers, I tend to do not games with special powers as demos.
Yeah.
But if they have special powers, magic, whatever, okay, here's how that works. And so, but basically, here is how each thing works, and if you want to do a thing, here is how you do it. Which very much comes down to, and I think GURPS is much better for this than many other games, to say, okay, in the version of this that is playing out in your head, what does your character try to do? And they can say something like, well, I'm going to attack him, but I think he looks pretty tough, so I'm going to attack him quite carefully, and it's more important to me that I not get hit than that I actually hit him, because I want to hold him off for my stronger mate over there to finish with his guy, as it might be. I mean, that's the thing a player has actually said to me, more or less. And I can say, right, in GURPS we can do this. It's called a defensive attack. You take this penalty to your attack, but you get this bonus to your defence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. And then it works. And they didn't have to know the magic GURPS technical words. But they can play the character the way they want it to.
Ideally, with any system, then you should be able to say to the player, don't worry about the rules. You tell you imagine your character and what they're going to do, and you tell me what you want to do. And I'll figure out a way.
I think this is a genuine difference with D&D and Pathfinder, which are very focused on, you have your basic stats and your basic to hit and whatever, but you also have a whole raft of nifty special abilities with nifty names, and one of the things that is valued in a player of those, as far as I can see, I I'm saying this as an outsider, I do not play these games these days, basically through lack of interest more than objection. But one of the things you're expected to be able to do is work out, well, you know, I've got this thing that I can use three times per day, whereas this thing I can use once per encounter, so I'll make sure I use that now, and then if things get tougher, then I'll use one of the three times per day powers, and that sort of resource management, which... I mean, diegetic resource management is fine. You know, I've only got so many crossbow bolts.
Yeah.
I'm not really interested in the game mechanical resource management, because to me that is the player's decision more than the character's decision.
I think
it's fuzzy, but that's the way I tend to feel about it.
I think if a thing like that exists, it should have a diegetic justification for it, and you should have a sense of why that world is like this. I was having a brief burst of enthusiasm for Earth Dawn recently,
mm-hmm.
and I tried reading the rules, and once I got through the long list or a long alphabetical list of all the special abilities the various types of characters can have, I had burned out most of that enthusiasm, which is probably unfair of me, but if I really care, if I had a good GM willing to run it for me, I would probably learn a lot of the system. But I am too old and lazy to pick up something like that at my age.
Yeah, I have a little rant that's coming up in the next Ever and Anon, which will be released probably within a few hours of our recording this, about the Doctor Who system, the second edition that you were running at StabCon.
Yeah, I have my own rants about it, but what were you focusing on?
Well, one of the thing that's particularly relevant here is that... In first edition, you have long list of traits, and these are basically advantages and disadvantages. And very often it's, I will get a particular bonus to using a skill in this kind of situation, or a disadvantage, I'm immediately recognisable and I have enemies all over the place, so that they will fixate on me as the big threat.
Yeah.
Which obviously you can take advantage of and, you know, have them following you while your friends do the hard bit.
Yeah,
But these are all gone in second ed.
Yeah.
And you have these distinctions instead. And they don't give you a list of distinctions. Now, I absolutely agree with you that looking through a long list of things is not great. And a first ed Time Lord might have a list of 20 traits.
Yeah.
And that is just too much. Even for me, a GURPS player. But... but I also think that having very few traits and saying, well, yeah, wave hands, just roleplay them a bit, is not great for the beginning players that this system is designed for.
No. I found second edition Doctor Who to be a good game for one-offs, but I as far as I can tell, the entire structure of an ongoing campaign has been collapsed out of it. And I really don't want to go anywhere near it on a long-term basis. But that said, I have run two good convention games at StabCon, and I may go back to it again, just because it's very easy to set up and to give a description in games terms of various sorts of character,
sure.
Realistic or fantastic. But...
I have a thing in mind which I think is actually better suited to first edition, because apart from anything else, first edition has the various characters from the series already started up in the various era source books.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So that's really easy to get them put together.
Yeah. All right. So, all right. Let me go back to my initial thought, which was showing off what this game is good at. You have been talking about the genres that a game can emulate, and that's important, especially if you're doing a generic system.
Well, particularly, if I come to the Yogg-Sothoth Games Con, my players are going to be people who already play Lovecraftian games.
Yeah.
And in offering them that, what I'm trying to do, the salesman aspect, which honestly is not a big part of what I do, I'm a very bad salesman, but what I'm trying to achieve here is, okay, you know how a Lovecraftian game can work. Here is how this system does it, and it does it pretty well.
Mm. Yeah. But there are games which are very dedicated to one particular sort of core activity. Investigative games are one. Action games are another. And the thing about them, I think they're the ideal sort of game you want to do demos on, because they are in themselves selling the core activity very hard, because the core activity is baked into the fantastical or baked into the mechanics of the game.
Mm. And one of the things about the Earthdawn system, and obviously it would be a candidate for GURPSifying, but one of the things it tries to get you to do is things like the world background detail that I really love, in fact one of the few I remember, is that everybody has to have a creative skill that they can demonstrate. Whether, writing a poem, sketching a cartoon, whatever, because that is the thing, the horrors that are the main threat cannot do creative stuff.
Because they are soulless and have no connection. Or they are victims of the horrors and have...
Because of the world rules.
Not because of the world rules, but because of the way the world actually is. And that's what I was saying earlier about diegetic justification for what your game system tells you.
And so what I would get out of that if I were running an Earthdawn demo is I will make a fuss about this. You know, there will be scenes where people have to do this. There will be scenes where the terribly respected person is unable to do the trivial creative thing, and obviously, you know, they're just not feeling it today. And, oh crap, that sort of thing. You know, I would build on that because it is a thing that is distinctive about the world.
Yeah, for that you want at least one ringer in the shape of somebody who knows what's going on. but the revelation of that to innocents who have only just come out of their cairn and are poking around in the world for the first time, that would be really neat.
Well, just one thing about character generation, if one is doing that, particularly in modern game that has quick character generation. Something like a Powered by the Apocalypse game, character generation is deliberately very light. You pick your major role and then you choose four or five multiple choice things, one of which is your name.
Yeah.
And then your character is ready to play. That's absolutely fine. That gives the players some feeling of involvement and agency before they even start the game.
It's not only fine, it also doesn't cripple the game. The game is designed... often with limits, but is designed for long-term play and for improvements and for making the characters more complicated as you go along. There, as I say, that is a demo leading to a long-term interest. And I will say that Apocalypse World, when I first played it, blew me away with that demonstration of how easy it was to create a character dedicated to this setting. But
at the same time, it is your character, and there may be others. There may be others like it, but not in this playgroup.
Yeah, and it is very big. Most of the systems are very big on niche protection and making each character in a group distinct, and that works very well. And that is that character generation and that creating a group is. It's not as strong in Apocalypse World as it is in Dungeon World, say, but creating a group quickly around the table and throwing you into the middle of the situation is what it's good at and what all of its derivatives tend to be good at.
Yeah, well, going back to that old Last Province article of mine, I think I recommended an in media res introduction. Because A, this gets you straight into any mechanics you're going to have to do. B, it doesn't have questions of motivation. Oh crap, those guys are attacking us. Let's try to survive this. And then C, it can lead into the main adventure. Why were they attacking us?
What you want, it can be entirely detached, like Bond cold opening scene. James Bond, boom. But it can be tied in as well. I don't think it's necessary to tie it in, but it does give you a feel.
But it can.
It can, yeah.
And I tend to feel the better James Bond scenes were, opening scenes were the ones that at least said, okay, yeah, you just did this, and as a result of the information you gathered while you weren't scurrying around, we have learned this, which is a problem, and now go and look into that. Rather than, oh, well, you know, shrug, you did a thing. I mean, yes, it works to show the audience who the character is, but I like to tie it together.
All right, I will take your sage advice.
The other thing to consider, of course, is the timing. I mean, well, the ones I've always been done, as I mentioned, this is the one session we are ever going to have. Therefore, it ought to have a damn solid conclusion.
Yeah. You need to... I don't think it necessarily has to run on rails, but I think you do need a very solid plan for where this is going to take you. And you should, of course, allow them to get out in ways that you hadn't thought of.
Absolutely.
But you need there to be a way that, several ways, if possible, for them to kill the big bad, save the princess, do whatever it is that needs to be done, planned in advance. But that's advice I think I make for any role-playing adventure.
Yeah, in particular, I like a bit of modularity. As you say, it doesn't have to be on rails necessarily. A clue web also works quite well, but it's nice if you can say this clue that would have been at level 5 in the web, we can suddenly bring back to level 3 because the players are playing slowly and the deadline's coming and we want to get them to the climactic scene rather than, okay, you know what's going on, now go home.
Yeah, the trick is to make them feel that they are... That they came up with it themselves, and not to obviously shuffle the
absolutely.
But that is something that is advice I have failed to follow on a number of occasions because I have sometimes actually said, "Let's hustle this along a little."
Well, I think one needs to do a certain amount of pace control as well, and if they're you know, faffing around and not really getting anywhere. You could send the guy through the door with the gun in his hand.
Or the clue that they requested at the start of the adventure, you can suddenly turn up when Q has...
Oh, hey, forensics has just got back to you.
Yeah, that works. I think... It's hard to know how elaborate you need to be. I'm certainly more elaborate in setting something up like this than I am for my regular role-playing sessions. But then my regular role-playing sessions are set in a universe where there is a certain amount of depth and I can call upon previously existing characters and existing situations to modify or add to it. But this, it has to be complete in itself and has to come to a satisfactory conclusion. Or at least leave the villain rushing off and saying you'll hear from me again.
No one could possibly have survived that.
Did you see the body?
We saw a body.
True.
Just before the shark ate it.
Okay, I will say that I have... I suppose that every first session I do of a new game system that I'm trying to convince my players to give a try, it ought to be as elaborate as this and as much of a selling job as this is. But I don't know that it always is. I think that's a related but slightly separate topic.
Yeah, but I've mentioned before, I think, that with GURPS campaigns in particular, since there's such a lot of variety in what one can do, even within a single genre and setting, I tend to treat the first episode or first session or first adventure as a pilot episode and explicitly encourage players to mess around with their characters and possibly even replace their characters once they've seen what I have intended to be generally how this campaign is going to run.
Yeah, I would say I would like in a demo game or in a convention game, I would like to see a sense that the characters know each other. enough background put in that you feel that this is a team that works together and has done things together before now. Even if the players don't pick up on it, I think it ought to be there, and it gives an excuse for the sweet role-playing and quips and banter back and forth, which is something so many people enjoy, which will be crowding in on your four-hour deadline.
Though also complete strangers in a high-pressure situation.
Yes,
the bar is under siege by zombies, that kind of thing.
Yeah. In my enthusiasm for zombies is very limited because...
Yeah, but if it's not zombies, it might be Maximum Overdrive and nobody wants to go there.
What? This is a cultural reference.
Stephen King's film of his own book. This is why Stephen King does not get to have an opinion on directing films anymore, because he did it once.
Which reminds me of Graham's one attempt at GMing. Oh dear, we were all Trollkin, and it was very frustrating.
I have at some point promised Watson Hall the all-duck RuneQuest game, but...
Wow! Yes, I have sympathy for the ducks.
Onward.
Onward.
Dice pools.
Oh, glory. Yes, let me just put the cat out.
There will only be a little bit of mathematics. Basically...
Have mercy on some. O-level was a long time ago.
Why are dice pools is what I'm really asking here. I think the first one I saw was the West End Games Star Wars, where rather than your skill being three, it might be three dice. But in that, basically, you still added them up and got a result. But in general, I think the way they work is you are rolling a bunch of dice. There is some criterion for saying that a particular value or range of values is a success. And then you want some number of successes, often one.
Yeah.
And
which I saw first with Vampire the Masquerade, I think.
Yeah, first one I played was Shadowrun. But yes, I think Vampire was the one that made it really popular, World of Darkness in general. And yeah, so you could also regard bonus and penalty dice in this light, because say you've got your D20 system game and you need to roll a 17 to succeed in the whatever,
yeah,
and you've got a bonus dice, and now you have a dice pool in effect, and the criterion for success is 17, right, yeah. And if either of them is that, you've succeeded. So it's basically a dice pool, just a small one. And then this spreads to percentile dice, and it gets very complicated. Because the lower value on the tens die of the percentile dice is not always the one you want.
Well, depending on system. No.
Because if you rolled a zero for your ones die,
yeah,
and one of your tens dice is a one and the other one is a zero, you want the one, because a double zero is a fumble. Whereas if you rolled a one on your ones die, you want the 0-1.
Okay, we're not in the mathematics yet.
But the point is, this is a way more complicated thing than a player should suddenly be confronted with at the table, I think.
Anyway. Well, look, there are players, and systems have been designed for players, who cannot add up 3d6.
Yeah, I'll come back to that. Special mention of Genesis, which you played in my Firefly game.
Can I rant about Genesis?
Go for it. I will just say, right, that the... part of the problem there is that to play a game, you need the dice, and they ain't making the dice anymore because it's not a trendy new game anymore. I have a big tin of them, but most other people don't.
I have, due to your enthusiasm for it, I have the app on my phone, so I could... But the point is, you gather a set of dice, each of which has some success or failure or special effect on it. You roll the whole damn lot of them, and then... You attempt. It's like performing divination from entrails. You're trying to figure out how you can describe the situation that has just occurred out of the mess that is before you, And if anybody in the world can calculate what the odds are, it's because the odds aren't of success or failure, not even of different kinds of success or failure, but of success or failure with complications and triumphs and disasters. And it's just, it's a failure of mathematics is what the hell it is. It is
calculable. I've done it, other people have done it, but I will absolutely agree with you that this is not a trivial exercise.
But it gets psych. What it does is increase the mental burden upon the GM.
Yes.
Because he's going to have to come up with all those special circumstances and make up something that gives the player all the disasters and all the triumphs that he's entitled to.
Well, I have said before that I find this sort of thing usually quite hard work, and for whatever reason, Genesis just clicked with me, and I think a lot of it is because there is this table, well, two tables, one for combat encounters and one for non-combat encounters, which basically say, OK, if you don't have any particularly great idea about what to do with those two advantages you just rolled... Well, here's a standard thing that is worth two advantages that will apply to almost anything. You can pass on a bonus die to the next guy to act, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that is a nice thing to be able to do. Sometimes I have a great visualization of the scene and I can say, well, okay, I did the thing, but I made a lot of noise and probably that's going to attract some guards or whatever. But if I don't have that, I can say, okay, sorry, Bob, I'm going to pass you a black die. And I don't have to stop and think about it. It doesn't break the pace. If I can't immediately come up with something, I'll use the generic and pass on. And that is, I think, what solves it for me. I understand this does not solve it for everybody. But coming back to one of your points here, even without the counteracting dice of something like Genesis, even when it's just successes and failures, it's not trivial to work out the probability.
All right.
I will just give one example on this. Say you're rolling a bunch of D6,
yeah,
and you need at least 1 6.
Yeah.
And the chance of getting at least of getting exact 1 6 when it's one die is 1 in 6.
Correct.
The chance of getting at least 1 6 is 1 minus 5 in 6. To the power of however many dice, because it's basically the chance of one minus the chance of rolling no sixes is how you work it out.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Is this Bayesian probability?
Yes.
Oh, but God. That's it. But not Bayesian probability!
I don't think it's technically Bayesian at this point. I'm not even going to go that far. But, yeah, this is one minus, open brackets, one minus x, close brackets, to the power n. Is not a thing that I expect players to do at the table.
Well, I don't know that the...
I've met players who, as you say, regard addition and subtraction as hard. Indeed, who regard subtraction as harder than addition. I regard this not as their fault. I regard this as the fault of their bloody awful maths teachers. I've had a few of those myself.
Well, I think, Roger, I've got to say, two points. First of all, everybody... Almost everybody has a limit to the mathematics they can absorb. And I hit mine at a point before Bayesian probability. My brother's an actuary, and therefore that's why I know about Bayesian probability. But I think you can have a sense of, from practice, if nothing else, a sense of what your odds are, your chances are, with a particular dice pool, even if you can't reduce it down to the precise odds.
Yeah, but this is where I come back to, I think I've mentioned before, the game They Came From Beneath the Sea, which I played a couple of years ago with Watson Hall.
Yeah.
I was not the GM in that. And that's essentially using a modified version of the early White Wolf system. So you roll a bunch of D10s, and this much or more is a success, this much or more is two successes, but if you get more ones than successes, then bad stuff has happened.
Yeah.
And that is remarkably non-trivial, because what the game requires you sometimes to need to get more successes, either to do a particularly complicated task or successes over what you needed for the task to activate one of your special powers. So now, as a GM, you need to say, okay, I've got these characters with, you know, maybe 3 to 6 dice in the thing that I'm interested in them doing. Mm. What? How likely are any of them to succeed in this 4 success task? And it's not obvious.
Well, it's just struck me that that problem is why you get the player facing mechanics.
But the thing is, you need to set a difficulty as the GM, unless you're running a pre-written adventure. Mm. And if you don't know how likely it is to work, you can't do that. For that particular game, I generated a table of the success probabilities and gave it to the GM. And his feeling was, well, yeah, great, now I've got this list of successes. I can use that, the percentages, I can use that. But why not just make it percentages? You know, what's so wrong with BRP? Say, OK, I've got 40% in this. I've got a 40% chance of doing this, and then I can put bonuses or penalties on that that will take it to 20% or 70%.
Yeah, this is us being our core grognard self. You do realise that I don't disagree. I am puzzled by all dice pool systems, even the ones that I like, because they always seem to be trying harder than is absolutely necessary to achieve something, and I never quite got why people are enthused about them.
Well, I think some of it is quite literally you don't have to add anything up, you just have to count things. Sometimes you have to count two things, which is adding up, but it doesn't look like it. You know, I've got this stack of D10s that I've just rolled for a World of Darkness type game, and I count the ones that are 7 or more, and then I add the ones that are 10 or more again. But, you know, that it doesn't feel like addition. It's not 5 plus 7. And apparently 5 plus 7 is hard.
Oh, right.
I would like to shout out to Outgunned here, which I've mentioned in passing before, because it is a dice pool system. It's basically you get between 3 and 6 D6, you roll them all together, and you look for matches. You don't care what the actual values are, you care how many of the same thing you've got.
Yeah.
And that gives you a probability table right there in the core rulebook. So if you want to know, if you want to set a 60% chance for a really good at what he does guy to do this thing, that's the difficulty you set. Thank you.
I have a certain amount of enthusiasm for Greg Stolze's creations, but his work on Rain, I'm afraid, stretched the brains of both my irregular gaming groups. Which is strange because I like it and I find it, but they are very much grognards as set at the stage of, well, GURPS and BRP are what they like or both groups like playing, and they hit hard against Rain, which is one of these roll a certain number of D10s equal to your stat and skill. And look for matches, and you do complicated things.
Well, that gets a two-dimensional outcome out of it, doesn't it? Because sometimes you want the highest number that's in a match, and sometimes you want the match that has most numbers in it.
Yeah,
what Outgunned does is basically just the latter part of that, just the size of it.
The highest is decides effectiveness. The widest decides speed. And that means the fast but not very good set can get in before the high but very good the short but very very good set. And then he went and did what's it called, Termination Shock, which is just too bloody silly for words. And creates, I don't know, it creates its own terminology which none of my players could pick up, and I'm not sure that I could pick up. And I asked myself, why, Greg Stolze, why do you do this thing to your admiring fans and patrons.
Well, that's the feeling I end up getting with playing things with Watson Hall, which is a group that is quite open to trying new systems. They're always happy to try new systems. But very often we end up feeling, well, this is a very flashy thing, but what does it actually offer that the old systems don't? And the answer is often, well, actually not very much.
Yeah.
Now, I think my takeaway on this is not dice pools bad, but if you are a game designer thinking about using dice pools, know what you are doing. Early White Wolf, famously, and clearly not famously enough because they came from Beneath the Sea, does this too, had a situation where your chance of a fumble would go up in some situations as your skill went up.
Hmm.
So in Beneath the Sea, you have a 10% chance if you have skill 1. If you have skill 2, it goes up to 16%. And then it gradually starts going down again.
Because, I think most later variants of this indicate that don't give you a certain fumble for a 1 anywhere.
Yeah, you can fix it, but the point is the designers didn't clearly do the probability calculation, so that they didn't realise this had happened. They just said, oh, well, it feels right, let's ship it. My advice to game designers is do the probability calculations. If you cannot do the probability calculations yourself, nothing wrong with that. AnyDice.com will do them for you.
Ooh, well, in that case, that's definitely a recommendation and a sign that we are living in the future.
It's not even a site that I run.
I would say that my advice to any game designers is throw it at a set of players and see what they do with it.
Yes, and human perception of probability is often very unlike actual probability. See my comments when we were talking earlier about demo games, that many video games will tell you one probability and actually give you another, and most players don't notice.
I find that peculiar. Why?
Yeah.
Why are they doing that?
The other thing I would say is it's an interesting thing for dice pool systems, and you may want it or you may not, but you should be aware that you're getting it, is you never get an absolute success or failure. Even in GURPS you can always fumble a thing.
Yeah.
But with a dice pool that's baked in, you can roll all the dice in the world, but just once in a while none of them will come up with a 6.
True.
And that should be a thing that the designer is aware of. You cannot simply say this task is trivial, you don't need to roll, automatically fallen out of the system. You may have to say it explicitly if that's the effect you want.
I have one player who has proverbially bad dice luck.
Mm-hmm.
He's not afraid of trying new systems, but he does have this conviction that he is a locus of bad luck at the opposite end of the table from me. And to a certain extent, it does appear to be the case. And I wonder about superstitious things. You know.
Have you tried a player-facing system with him?
Ah.
And does the same thing happen? They're one of the players in Watson Hall is also particularly bad at rolling stuff, especially during character generation. He wasn't in the outgunned session I've run, and I'm really curious to find out whether that keeps happening, whether he rolls well for the bad guys shooting at him and poorly when he's trying to do stuff himself.
Yeah. All right, well, having resorted to superstition and talked about probability, I think it's time for us to move on. If you wish to send us a copy of your thesis about dice probability, or if you want to tell us the story of your infernal bad dice luck, you can contact us via...
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.li.
And we will be back to ramble on again in another month's time. Yeah.